Have you ever tried to hide a light in a dark room? I remember as a child giving my mother a hard time at bedtime. She would send me to bed, and I would go, but I would sneak a book and a flashlight with me. And so she'd tuck me in, and as soon as I'd listen to her footsteps as they go down the stairs, and then as soon as I thought she was out of the way, up the covers went over my head with my book and flashlight underneath, and I'm reading. Invariably, she would catch me every time. The next time I try it, I'm tucking the covers underneath, trying to get every little crack, you know, tucking it all, getting all cocooned up. Still, she would catch me. She would pull back the blanket and give me that look that said, "Busted." Hiding a light is almost impossible. Light will find the slightest opening, the thinnest crack, and the smallest hole to escape and shine in darkness. Jesus knew the power of light in the world. In the Sermon on the Mount, he said, "You are the light of the world." He wanted his followers to understand the importance of their witness in a world ignorant of God's love. Jesus knew when God's love is released through acts of human kindness, it is like light in the darkness. No matter how hard people may try to hide the light of love, it always will find an opening through which to shine hope, courage, and strength. As disciples of Christ, we must hear these words of Jesus with a new urgency. Our lives are filled with uncertainty, fear, and suspicion. We may want to retreat into the safety of our unfamiliar rituals and comfortable habits, yet the light of God's love must shine ever more steadily as the turmoil of our world grows. And I think the events of this past week have shown us just how much the turmoil of our world is growing. In order to understand about the projects and their importance to the communities in which they serve, we need to start with a little bit of information. The purpose of my trip was to become a spokesperson for One Great Hour of Sharing and to learn about community-based primary health care programs, which is really what a lot of the GBGM missions and projects, advanced special projects, are based on. For those of you who are not aware, One Great Hour Sharing is actually next Sunday, and we will be taking a special offering for that to do our part. But that was my purpose for the trip. The spouses of the bishops were asked by UMCOR to start a covenant for this and to promote One Great Hour Sharing in their conferences, and our bishop's wife, Melba Whitaker, thought that it was an opportunity to utilize spouses of clergy to help in that mission and to help support that covenant and give us a ministry, because a lot of times we kind of are on the sidelines from our husband's ministry, and kind of it would give us something that we could do. And so Brazil was the first trip planned in her vision of working with the clergy and making spokespersons throughout the conference. And I was lucky enough to go on this trip, and there's going to be another trip later this spring, and I think they've got a third one scheduled for later in the fall. Next slide, please. A little bit about Brazil. Brazil is the largest country in landmass in South America, yet only 4% of the population owns land. And it's significant because the landowners, who are the elite rich of the country and control almost all political decisions and agencies. There's a small middle class and an extremely large lower class living in poverty. Poverty in this term makes our housing authority type in communities and welfare. Our people that are on welfare and such live like kings and queens compared to what I'm talking about in poverty in this country. Jobs are categorized on minimum wages, which took us a while to catch on to, but a minimum wage is about the equivalent of $80 a month. For example, a pastor, an office worker, a teacher, and I put pastor up there, It's said to have earned about 3 minimum wages, or about $240 to $250 a month. At this amount of money, you would not own a car and would live in a modest home. Modest being you may have electricity, but probably not a phone. You probably wouldn't have a television, and if you did have a television, you wouldn't have cable or satellite or anything like that. Because of the high cost of rent and the shortage of housing, employees have to travel far. The cities are spread out. They're huge. And so if a lot of the poorer people or the middle class people actually are on the outskirts of the city, with the very rich in the middle, then there's the middle class, and then up in the hills from the cities are the slums. And so those middle class people traveling from the outskirts of the city, traveling and have a long way to go with no car. And so public transportation is important. And because of that, a lot of employers offer, as part of their employees' benefits, they receive 2 bus vouchers a day so that they can get to work and from work. They also, a lot of employers have found that they make a deal with a restaurant near the job, and they give them a meal voucher for their lunch. That may be the main meal that person eats that day. And they have found that by providing those 2 items to their employees, they're healthier and their attendance is better because they can get to and from work. Next. This slide is just to show you, those of you, if you remember back, we collected materials, hygiene products, school supply, medical type thing, baby things, and all 8 of us who went collected. And we all had an extra suitcase full of nothing but supplies, and when we got there, we put them out. We had 3 big tables full of supplies, and we separated them into categories. And then Lou Garcia, who arranged our trip, and you'll hear more about her throughout, she actually sat down and said, okay, this program you'll see in Victoria, they could use these supplies desperately, so we'll box those and send them off to there. And so all of the materials actually went to projects that we then went and visited. And we saw our materials. They kind of got ahead of us, and we were able to see them as we went along. Oh, sorry, honey. Okay, most of the projects are based on the community, community-based primary health care program. It was developed by a husband and wife team from India who came and trained in the United States as doctors and then went back to their communities and went out into Junket, if anybody's familiar with that community. And they started by teaching the people, and if you know, in India they have the class system, the untouchables and everything, and there was no mixing of the classes. And what they did is their goal was to teach people from each class general health care, hygiene, things that weren't causing infant mortality rates and disease and other things, but general high information, education, how to farm, that kind of stuff. They were teaching each class to then go back and teach the people in their community. So, but this was very successful and became a model. And the whole goal of it was to provide equality, that all the classes become part of the solution, integration, that all groups within the community work for a common good of the community, and empowerment, self-esteem, that everyone within the community has ability and worth, and especially those without opportunity. And the whole idea is that when people are living in poverty, they lack opportunity. And so they try to give them opportunity so then they can become a part of the solution and do it themselves. And that's the kind of the whole idea of community-based primary health care. And it's a holistic approach dealing with mental, physical, psychological, spiritual, and education. Next slide, please. In Brazil, the Central Methodist Church of Brazil made it challenged all of the churches in the all their conferences to provide shade and fresh water. And shade and fresh water simply said, no matter how small, no matter how poor, no matter how limited your church is, look at your community, find a need that needs to be addressed in your community, and do something for it, whatever little bit you can. And they came up with all kinds of ideas. So programs you're going to look at are daycare, providing meals, providing activities, providing tutoring help, and it went on and on and on. Just real creative things. So that was what, and it was called Shade and Fresh Water, which as I went through the process of visiting the projects, it became so clear just how neat that whole concept of shade and fresh water is. Our first place that we went was the Central Methodist Church in First Church, actually, of St. Paul. And this just is our whole group. There's the eight of us from the United States. And just to point out a few, we always had an interpreter with us. And in St. Paul, our interpreter was Melanie, who was the first one on the left. And then, of course, there's me there. And next to me is Melba Whitaker, our bishop's wife. Next to Melba is Kelly Jewett, who traveled with us. She was one of the eight, and she is actually a GBGM missionary who was just returning from 2 years in Africa. She had served in India, she'd been to Africa twice, and she was in the process of waiting for her next assignment. And she is a certified doctor from Kansas who put away the idea of private practice and working in a hospital to go into ministry. Really awesome lady. And next to her is Lou Garcia, who was the director of CMOL, which has to do with Methodist churches in all of Latin America. And she was the one that developed our itinerary and kind of made all the arrangements for us to come. Next slide, please. The program at the First Church in San Pal was called AMOS. And AMOS served 75 children from four families, infants to 12 years of age. The children attend public school for 4 hours, either in the morning or in the afternoon. Their schools are so crowded that they have to go morning session or afternoon session. They can't go all day. The children, at AMOS, the children are provided with breakfast, singing and praise, art activities, and then 1 hour of help with their homework or study time and recreation. The parents are mostly street vendors and service workers with little education. AMOS works with the families offering parenting and other useful workshops. And for example, when we were there on Wednesdays, parents would come and learn how to make a very popular cheese bread that's very popular in Brazil. They would learn how to make it themselves because it was something that could be made very cheaply, yet they could sell it to make money to help supplement and help get them so that they could live in a better environment. AMOS is funded through a partnership between the church and the government. The building that AMOS was housed in was about 6 stories tall and actually given to the church and owned by the church. 2 floors housed the children of the AMOS program, and the other floors were rented to a university nursing program. The church had an agreement with the nursing program to provide them with space in return for the nursing school providing the children and their families with health care. And as the program developed, they found 2 dentists, a father and son, who volunteered their time to help with dental care. And they also had a psychologist volunteer his time to help. So the first lesson that I learned right away and saw throughout my trip was that the programs, they're very resourceful in how they could manage to get things going. And this type of ingenuity continued throughout. The program makes great use of recycled materials for the children's art programs. One of their completed projects that we observed was a huge model of the city with buildings, water, trees, streets. And it was all made from recycled materials, materials that had been thrown away and just found around, and they built this huge project. It was very clever the way it was done. They used things that I wouldn't have thought to use that way. The way that they would get some of their recycled material is they would make an appeal for donated materials from local businesses. And in turn, the businesses would receive a T-shirt with that one of the children had done artwork on the front. So that was the thing that they would then in turn give back to the business for donating. Next slide, please. And just a little bit about education, because a lot of our programs deal with children and education. In Brazil, like I said, that the schools were crowded, a classroom had 30 to 50 students, all grades. And the students attended, like I said, 4 hours a day. It was strictly academics. There were no extra electives, art, music, sports, home ec, languages, none of that, except they did teach English as well as Portuguese. Other than that, it wasn't like you could take Latin for an elective or whatever. And the parents, even though it was a public school, parents had to pay for uniforms, textbooks, and the meal plan and other materials. And if the parent could not pay, even though it was public, the child could not go to school. And a lot of times the children had to travel very far to school in Vitória, which I don't have any programs covered today on Vitória. Those children that we saw had to cross a 6-lane highway to get to school. And very often, I'm talking interstate highway, with no walk bridge across. That was one of the things as a community they were trying to work for, but they were still considered a slum, so they didn't get a whole lot of what they wanted. And they had many deaths from their children with their cars hitting them while they were trying to go to school. New slide, please. The next program we saw was a special ed program and work program for adults with Down syndrome. It was a 27-year-old program, had been established for 27 years, had operated with 80 students ages 15 and up. And the school contracts labor skills with area companies to earn money for the school and the students. In the picture on the lower left-hand corner, the students are folding and packaging ironing board pads. The school also folds and packages vacuum cleaner bags and several other projects such like that. And it was really ingenious how they taught the kids to do it, because they would have a cardboard folded the exact size. And they taught them how to fold the item around the cardboard and slip it out. And then they'd hand it to the next person, and the next person would put it in the bag and hand it to the next person. And that person's job was to fold the flap and put the, seal it. So they had it all figured out. When the students were not working, they participated in soccer, as you can see. And they also participated in arts and crafts. But they used the arts and crafts there again to make money for their school. And I have some of the arts and crafts that they did back on my table to make extra money. The money that they received from the companies, not only part of it went to the school, but part of it went to the student to pay for their labor, which I thought was really neat. Next slide, please. The third project we went to see is in Brazil, and I'm not saying the Portuguese names because I will slaughter them. So that's why I'm just let them up there for you to read. But in Brazil, the elderly are referred to as third life. And the purpose of this project is to provide the elderly poor a place to come to daily where they develop friendships, socialize, learn new job skills, have the opportunity to attend arts and theater events, and attend activities where they are taught to exercise their minds and bodies. This church saw a great deal of poverty, depression, and a need for community involvement among the third life. The church opened their fellowship hall and with volunteers made a place for them to come. In the top picture, they're exercising to music. And it was really cute because it was music from the Pirates of Penzance. And it's hard to see, but what they have up, that's their swords. And they draw their swords, and they've got an actual person directing them, and it's the motion that's helping to move them and keep the exercise. It was neat. Let's see. The bottom picture shows where they did a presentation dancing and singing for us. And then the third one shows the ladies busy at work on their needlecraft. And there again, they were doing different kind of art projects that they could sell to raise money. Selling along the streets and door to door is very common in Brazil because for a majority of the poverty people, that's the only way that they can kind of build themselves up. Next slide, please. The last place I went to in São Paulo before we moved on to Belo Horizonte is probably the most emotionally difficult program for me to observe. I only have the one picture, and I just have to read this because I had to really put my thoughts down on paper to really make this understandable. The last place we visited in São Paulo made me very ill, and I'm literally sick to my stomach. What was probably the most intriguing. It was a muggy, rainy night. We were all quite surprised when our driver pulled over onto the sidewalk on top of a 6-lane traffic bridge over an 8-lane highway. And our interpreter said that we were here and got out of the van. We were led to a set of stairs that reminded me of entering a subway station in Washington, D.C. or Atlanta. Once we were underneath, we realized that the homeless shelter was built suspended from the bottom of the bridge. The first thing that hit me was the smells. We entered into a room about the size of this sanctuary, but a little wider. Dinner was being served, and the smell of food mingled with human. The bath and exhaust fumes. Two large fans did little but move and mix the smells. We were then shown the different areas of the shelter. There was the men's sleeping quarters that was a similar size room with rows and rows of bunk beds with just enough room to maneuver between them. And it was full to capacity. Then we went to a small storage area with lockers. It was explained that every person who attends the shelter has a locker to store their personal belongings in. And when each person signed in, they were given hygiene products to use. A sign-up sheet was used for everything from showers, chores, because each person was supposed to participate in chores. They had washing machines and ironing boards and sign-up sheets for that. And also they provided workshops and activities, and they had sign-up sheets for that. At one point, I was able to look out the open windows of a room, and that's when I realized that there was an eight-lane highway below us. No wonder the exhaust fumes were so strong in the shelter. Finally, we were shown the women and children's sleeping quarters. That area was about half the size of this, and that was where I met Lucinda. Lucinda is a 12-year-old who was homeless with her mother and father. She has been at the shelter for about 2 weeks after living on the street for 4 months. Her parents were not able to make a go of it in the country and thought that things would be better in the big city and took off and came and were basically found that things weren't any better and they were homeless. The shelter placing has allowed for her to finally go back to school. She and her mother sleep in twin beds grouped together and surrounded by clothes hanging on lines that were zigzagged across the room. And they had their little area and then the other, you know, the next little family, and the women and children were kind of grouped like that. The fathers of those families were in the other end of the shelter. They couldn't even stay together. Our shelters could learn a lot from this shelter. Even though the residents have to leave by a certain time in the morning and be back inside during a certain time period in the evening, just like our shelters here in town, once admitted to the program, certain things happen. They're admitted for a period of 6 months to get their lives back together, 12 to 18 months if it's women and children. During that time, if they miss any evening, one evening, they're out of the program. They have to come back and report in to the shelter and be there every night. Drugs and alcohol use gets them knocked out of the program. Because they have a waiting list for the shelter. They may receive calls and mail at the shelter, so they're able to use the shelter as an address and phone number for contact and finding a job, which is one of the problems our homeless has. If they have no home and phone number, that's when an employer wants to know, and it's like a vicious catch-22. The shelter made arrangements for that. They have workshops for life skills, how to fill out an application, different things. And the other thing is if there's any animosity of not participating in the program correctly, or if there is an argument and there's a fight breaks out, the guilty parties are removed from the program. So everything is very calm in the shelter. While they are at the shelter, they must show proof of trying to seek gainful employment. And once they have a job, they can still stay at the shelter for several months in order to save money so that they can pay those deposits and pay for their first month's rent and pay for the things that they're going to need in order to establish themselves once they get out. This program is extremely successful in San Pal. Okay. Then we traveled on to Belo Horizonte. This was the poorest project I saw, or one of the poorest. And Belo Horizonte, just to give you I got to speed it up, he said. The bottom lower corner, that's the dining room. This church is in a slum of 30,000 people. When we got out of the van, we had to jump over a foot to foot and a half river of raw sewage running down the road. Well, the unpaved road. They provide education and a place for these kids to go, because what's happening in Belo Horizonte is that in Brazil, if you are under 16 years old and caught with drugs, you are not prosecuted. So the drug runner, you know, the drug dealers, they got smart. Guess who they're going to use to run their drugs? They're going to use kids, because those kids a lot of times don't have food. Their mother or father is off trying to make a little bit of money to do what they can, so they have no supervision. They're out on the streets. They're easy targets. Well, a group of citizens in Belo Horizonte decided, hey, we don't like them hanging out on the streets. We don't like them, and we figured it out. If they're not able to prosecute it, if we get rid of those street kids, then the drug dealers will have to run their own drugs. And so a vigilante group started going around killing the street children. So this church started their program with their meager facilities to provide a safe haven for the children to come off the streets too. They provide three meals a day, bread in the morning, macaroni at lunchtime, and rice in the evening. And if they're lucky enough to get a donation of chicken or vegetables, they put it amongst it and to go as far as it can. They're right next to the top building at the top. We're looking at the educational part. Right next to it is their little sanctuary. This facility, although poor, was a very good facility. They had started a second one in another area of the same slum neighborhood. And that one, they had a sanctuary with concrete foundation and four brick walls, because that was as far as it's gotten. They had no roof or anything, and they still were providing the meals and providing a place for the kids to go and help with their homework. Very shade and fresh water, doing what they can with what they have. Just unreal. Now, this is in another community in Belo Horizonte, and this is a program that has been established for over 20 years. Tekka and Gordon Greathouse, who are also missionaries from GBGM from the United States, they have been there for 20 years. They started the program by offering recreation under a tree. Now the program has a community center, a daycare center, and then the next slide is a habitat community that is a branch off of their existing community. And over the course of 20 years, within about 5 years ago, the women came together and organized. And they got the government to come in and put in electricity in their community, pave their roads, put in sewer, put in water, so that it doesn't look like a slum anymore. It's really cleaned up. It's a community. The government was so impressed, they then took a little group area of land about 45 minutes out of the city that they didn't like, that could not grow anything. It was like a toss-off land. They kind of deemed uninhabited, but they made it happen. Oh, you can have this land. And out of 1,600 applications, the women decided the criteria and picked 200 families who then went 45 minutes out of the city every weekend with their families and built a Habitat house. And their own house, when I'm talking a Habitat house, I am talking about a dirt floor, 12 by 12 square feet, and just clay red bricks that are cheap and easy to get in Brazil, walls, and then a thatch or tin roof. But they built their Habitat house. This is the community center that they built in the center of the Habitat community. They have like neighborhood rules, and I mean, it's just really developed. And they all did it themselves. And a lot of these children, or a lot of these women and adults who've done this in this community, were children in the program years and years ago when the program started. But they have gone on and now have come back and are giving to their community. That's a successful program. And that's what community-based primary health care is all about. Empowering the people. The missionaries that I got to meet, Tetha, and I don't have a picture of Gordon, her husband. They're at the top. And then, of course, Kelly I mentioned before. And down at the bottom in the blue is Lou Garcia, who was the one who arranged our trip. She is a new missionary. She just went through all the training and all the information. Her husband's a pastor, and she is now a missionary with GBGM and is looking for churches to help support her to go out on mission. Wonderful people. So, what does that mean to us? This is just one country that is benefiting from 1 hour of sharing and from our local churches joining together and doing what we can. Pastor, I borrowed this from Pastor, from Steve, this is the advanced specials that are provided for through UMCOR. And quit laughing at me. And they're basically broken down into areas, United States included. We have programs here in the United States. When we give to 1 hour of sharing and all the churches join together, we keep the organization going and we keep some support for the programs. That's kind of bottom line. But there are a couple other ways that if we as a church choose to, somewhere down the road, go farther into missions and really look at this, we could pick a missionary and support, make a covenant with them to help sponsor them. And or we could do special fundraisers to raise money and pick an advanced special and to give to just that particular project. And we're able to do that by looking at the particular number. And if we take that choice, 100% of the money that's given to that project goes to the project. That's not to say that 1 hour sharing isn't important, but it's kind of like the second mile. That's what they call it. 1 hour sharing is the first initial mile. We want to go the second mile. These are some options that we as a church have that we might want to think about, pray about, and look at in the future. And kind of to quickly sum it up, Jesus said, and I couldn't find where, "Let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father in heaven." Through missions, we let our light shine. We do things that we can't go out and do ourselves. Would you please join me in a prayer?